Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, January 26th. Let's jump right in today with one of the new history-making members of Congress from New York, one of the new progressives who ran with the backing of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to see what it's been like getting caught in an insurrection during your first week at your new job, how he thinks Joe Biden is doing so far as president, how to fight the pandemic and inequality, and much more. Our guest is Mondaire Jones, who succeeds Congresswoman Nita Lowey, who retired from the district covering all of Rockland County and parts of Westchester, roughly from White Plains to the Tappan Zee Mario Cuomo Bridge. Mondaire Jones grew up in Section 8 subsidized housing in Rockland, Spring Valley, went on to Stanford University and Harvard Law School, has worked in the Obama Justice Department and the Westchester County Law Office. He's a progressive from the suburbs, along with Richie Torres from the Bronx. He has also just become one of the first two members of Congress to be both African-American and openly gay. He has gotten a seat on the prestigious House Judiciary Committee. He was also one of the first, on January 6th itself, to call for the second impeachment of Donald Trump, and also, and we'll talk about this, for the expulsion of members of Congress who voted to reject the election result. Congressman Jones, thanks so much for some time with us today. I got to congratulate you after you won the primary last summer, and now congratulations on being elected and taking your seat.
Brian, thanks for having me on. It is always a joy to connect with your listeners.
And we've heard many stories from other members of their experiences during the insurrection. Would you like to add to this oral history and share something from those hours that you think you'll never forget?
Well, you know, not to re-traumatize myself or anyone who was watching on television as the events were unfolding, but, you know, I was in the House chamber. I was in the thick of it, listening to what was supposed to be a routine certification of a free and fair election from last November. It was anything but that. It was a series of public statements by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, raising issues without evidence. And then all of a sudden, to make matters more dramatic, we received an announcement from either the sergeant in arms or someone from the Capitol Police that the Capitol had been breached and that the people who had breached the Capitol were likely making their way to the House chamber where we were located. Now, I was in there seated on the floor with Democratic leadership, but also there were approximately 200 of us there, if you count the folks who were on the floor and the folks in the gallery overlooking the House floor. We were instructed to look under our seats for gas masks in the event that tear gas needed to be used. We were told to step away from any of the doors in the room because those would be locked from the inside. And we were also told to prepare to lie down on the ground of the House floor in the event of gunfire. And then shortly thereafter, there was a very loud banging sound from the mob of domestic terrorists who had indeed found their way to the House chamber. Thankfully, in the nick of time, we were able to evacuate and to a more secure location. But it was a very harrowing experience, to say the least. And many of us thought that we might not make it out of that room.
Yeah. Now, you were one of the first, before that day was out, to call for Trump to be impeached a second time. Now we know a Senate trial will begin in 2 weeks. But early headcounts of Republicans indicate he will likely get acquitted again. So how concerned are you that centering him right now, after he's out of office, rather than just marginalizing him, will leave him with more power than if you had just denounced him?
I am not concerned by that because it is actually not an issue. Donald Trump would be centered in our politics if he were not convicted and then barred from ever running for federal elected office moving forward. This is the party of Donald Trump with respect to today's Republican Party. He has a chokehold or a death grip over a significant share of the Republican electorate And it is why you are seeing people who know well that he bears responsibility, primary responsibility for what happened on January 6th, who are deflecting, if not outright lying, about their solemn responsibility to convict him during this Senate trial. We are seeing Donald Trump already threaten to create a new party, as he calls it, and to run primary challenges to incumbent Republicans who, you know, have not shown, from his perspective, sufficient loyalty to him. So, you know, Tish James and other prosecutors will do their part in making sure that he is held accountable under state and local law, and I think federal law as well, when it comes to this new attorney general, I hope. But we have to make sure, from a political perspective, that we diminish his ability to do what he did on January 6th, which was incite an attempted overthrow of the federal government, and which nearly led to the massacre of hundreds of members of Congress, including members of the Senate.
Yeah, but that's the question, isn't it? Politically, what will the effect of this process be? Will it be to weaken him, or if he's acquitted, which would largely be because he is successfully exerting power through the electorate on the senators who at some point will have to stand for re-election, does it strengthen him?
No, there is no strengthening of him were he to be exonerated by Republicans in the United States Senate. He is at his most influential in this moment within the party. And the only thing that can be done right now is to diminish that influence. And this is an issue of democracy. This isn't politics. It's why you have people like Mitt Romney and McConnell saying that, yes, Donald Trump clearly does bear responsibility for what happened on January 6th. If we don't impeach him for this thing, what in the world would we impeach and then convict him for? If not the attempted overthrow of the United States government, despite being at the time the sitting president of the United States. So it is a straw man, people saying, and it's not rooted in actual analysis, people saying that somehow he's going to become stronger if there's an exoneration. We just become weaker as a democracy if we don't stand up to this person who is antithetical to what we stand for as a country.
I don't want this to get lost. I want to ask you and give you an opportunity to tell a story about an immigration case that you got involved in for a constituent in these early days of yours in Congress that is both frightening and heartwarming. As one of the Trump administration's final acts, they were trying to deport a 40-year-old financial consultant from Rockland named Paul Pierilis. Would you pick up the story from there and tell it to our listeners?
About two Mondays ago, I was on a treadmill getting in a much-needed workout when I got a voicemail from an unknown number. And I listened to the voicemail, and it was the attorney for a constituent of mine, an upstanding member of the Spring Valley and therefore Rockland County community. And his name was Paul Pierilis. And she said in the voicemail that her client was on the cusp of being illegally deported to Haiti, a country where he has never been. He was born in St. Martin, has never been to Haiti. And so my staff and I, you know, immediately took action. I even at the time, I was not aware that he was scheduled to be deported basically, you know, less than 24 hours later. But, you know, we were on the phone until 2 a.m. demanding from ICE that they produce to us and what's called an approved travel document. You know, whenever you deport somebody somewhere, that country, the recipient country, has to authorize that deportation. And of course, Haiti, you know, the Haitian ambassador subsequently said on Twitter that, you know, Mr. Pierilis is not a citizen. He has no connection to Haiti. And so this was indeed an illegal or an attempted deportation that was illegal. It was unconstitutional. Thankfully, with moments to spare, as Mr. Pierilis was on the tarmac in handcuffs and shackles, those were removed from him because of our intervention and the obviously important work of his attorney as well in reaching out to us. And he since then has, last I heard, still been in detention, which is the other thing that needs to change. He must be reunited with his family and with our community in Rockland County. He is a contributing member of our society. He's an upstanding member of our community. And we saw this in connection with a ramping up in the final days of the Trump administration of what has for years under that president been a fairly racist, xenophobic, cruel immigration deportation regime and program. And thankfully, under President Biden, he has, by executive action, done a 100-day pause on deportation so that we can analyze who we are actually deporting in this country, so that we don't include other people like Mr. Peerless. And then, of course, as that's happening, Congress needs to be enacting comprehensive immigration reform.
The part of that story that I didn't know, and tell me if I heard you right, is that he's still in detention?
That is my understanding. And we have been in contact with his family, with his attorney. My understanding is that he is in Louisiana in an ICE detention facility. It's not like, by the way, ICE is very communicative about these things. It took many, many hours and many emails and many conversations in order for us to even get on the phone with ICE, which, as many of you know, is an agency of DHS, the Department of Homeland Security.
Let's take a call from a constituent, Bob in Ossining. You're on WNYC with Congressman Mondaire Jones. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Congressman Jones. First of all, congratulations on all the work you're doing to protect democracy. My question is about what the prospects are for action by Congress and the administration this year as part of their Build Back Better, that we would see tangible effects in our district that would rebuild the middle class and prepare us for the green economy. I've seen proposals from the Regional Plan Association that are very classic, but I don't see things like bury the power lines so we're ready for an electrified world and we won't lose power during storms. I don't see things about 5G. So could you just share how you hope to shape whatever the administration brings forward? Thank you.
Bob, I so appreciate that question, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to weigh in on that. This is something that I'm very passionate about. The Transportation and Infrastructure Committee is chaired by Congressman DeFazio, and in the 116th Congress, which was prior to this year, he made a pretty significant proposal that included resources for projects like what you just described. We have seen, obviously, in this district, a number of storms just decimate our communities because we have failed to invest in the infrastructure in the way that a civilized society ought to, frankly, in 2020 or 2021, where we now are. And so I'm going to be fighting to make sure we get resources to bury those power lines. Now, I've actually had this conversation with Supervisor George Homan over in the town of Clarkstown, which is in Rockland, and I know that town supervisors throughout our district in Westchester and in Rockland feel the same way. We have to make sure that we are prepared. But also, you know, I think what I also heard in your question was about climate as well. And that means that as we think about investing in public transportation as part of an infrastructure bill, we understand that the transportation sector is the single biggest contributor to carbon emissions globally. And so we need to do more investments in transit, including light rail, which we used to have in places like Peekskill and Ossining. And so as we wean ourselves off of reliance on cars and push towards public transportation, hopefully that is high speed, we will get to a place where we are getting net zero carbon emissions, which obviously is the goal. It's not going to happen overnight. This president and I, you know, we differ, I think, on some of the details. I am more ambitious in what I want to see with respect to climate. But the fact remains that he has proposed the most ambitious climate policy of any president in the United States in history. And so I'm really proud to be working to iron out those details. And historically, this has been something that has enjoyed bipartisan support. So let's hope that my Republican colleagues get on board with that.
That's interesting praise of Biden coming from you, because if we look at climate as an example of something where the progressive wing of the party and the more moderate, or whatever the right other term is, for other members of the party, that's an example where I would have thought there would be some difference coming out of the gate. So, like, Biden has issued a number of executive orders already. We'll remind people, no more drilling on federal lands, no more Keystone XL pipeline, rejoin the Paris Climate Accords, but he hasn't adopted the full Green New Deal in the way I think you ran on it. So give me a Biden climate report card so far as you see it that includes that.
I think he's done a great job on climate, and it's why you see organizations that are the biggest champions of the Green New Deal, like the Sunrise Movement, give him accolades for what he proposed on the campaign trail. And I think you'll continue to see that. You know, Chuck Schumer, Majority Leader Schumer, is saying that climate is his number one priority next to COVID relief. We all are prioritizing COVID relief. Obviously, I'll be back in D.C. next week to hopefully vote on a COVID relief bill. I was speaking with Speaker Pelosi yesterday about that. And so, you know, we all get it. And this president is no exception. I think he's shown tremendous leadership on the issue of climate.
Go ahead.
Yeah. It doesn't mean we agree on timelines, and, you know, but it's quite ambitious what he has proposed. And you have seen, I think, the progressive movement move him in that direction because he hasn't always been there. This is existential. It is also a jobs creation program. To Bob's question earlier, how do we rebuild the middle class? Well, let's create millions of good paying jobs in the clean energy space. And let's make this part of a transportation and infrastructure bill. And by the way, another way that we're going to build back the middle class is by passing this COVID-19 relief bill, which contains, as it has been proposed for now, $350 billion for states and local municipalities, many of which had to lay off people by the tens of thousands because of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We've got money in this bill for child care. We've got money. We've got, obviously got the survival checks, which I think should be on a recurring basis. That's another area where I'm more ambitious than what the president has proposed. But this is direct relief now for people in this district. And obviously, when we get out of COVID through finally having a national testing and vaccination strategy, the economy will reopen completely. And we'll be able to dine out, and people will have money again to invest in the economy, and many people who have been laid off will be put back to work. It is also the case in the interim period that COVID-19 relief bill includes an extension of the Supplemental Unemployment Insurance Program.
By the way, you mentioned Senator Schumer, and being from the progressive AOC endorsed in your primary wing of the party, I heard on MSNBC this morning that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez is considering primarying Schumer in the next election cycle. Do you think that would be good for the party and good for the country?
I am not aware of any plans for her to do that, and I would direct that question to her.
Edmund in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Congressman Mondaer Jones. Hi, Edward. Edmund.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for taking my question. I think the biggest problem that we've got underlying all of this, right, is that there's an alternative reality. And we can say, oh, we want to agree on some sort of common facts. But as soon as you say that, it means that someone has to be wrong in terms of what truth is, et cetera. How are we going to go out and level set, and because there is an incentive for people to once they see that they've been lied to, you know, that there's going to be some energy that comes from that in a good way, you know, in the sense that we're kind of coming together. How are we addressing, and how do you plan on addressing that? Because that, without alienating, without pointing fingers, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, for instance, did that documentary 2 years ago. I think it was called Outside the Bubble or something. And, you know, there's a genuine outreach to better understand. And how are we going to continue to invest in that understanding as opposed to feeding that button that I like to push, which is to, you know, read the ridiculousness that's just coming out of Florida and all the insanity on the one hand just makes me easy to say, you know, they're daft. But it's much more serious than that. How are we going to address that?
Edmund, I so appreciate that question. It is something I think about every day. It drives me crazy that there is a televised propaganda machine known as Fox News, really, but some other networks, that just spouts lies every day. And it's like, you know, normally you'd be able to agree on a set of facts and maybe you'd still reach a different conclusion. But now half the country, or nearly half the country, believes that the November election was stolen from the President of the United States without there actually being any evidence of mass fraud. And so it is something that is existential to our democracy. It must be addressed. I think one of the very first things we can do is get people elected to Congress who will push back on that narrative from within the Republican Party. And that starts with the democracy reforms contained in a piece of legislation known as H.R. 1, the For the People Act. When you end partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts, you force people to compete in general election contests and be responsive to the electorate, to speak with facts and to respond to rational people. Whereas right now, if you prevail in the primary in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district or Lauren Boebert's district, well, actually, you know, Lauren may have a difficult time in 2 years because it's not like she won by a landslide. But Marjorie Taylor Greene's district in Georgia, you can coast to victory despite being a QAnon conspiracy theorist who peddles lies about pedophilia and like eating babies and other crazy nonsense. So when you have a more moderate Republican Party, the one that is responsive to facts, you won't get a situation like what we saw on January 6th, where a majority of the Republican caucus voted to overturn the presidential election, despite the fact that none of them, and I don't know if you've seen some of these CNN interviews that Nicole Malliotakis and Madison Cawthorn have done, but they can't even defend what they did when they go on TV, when they're just, you know, asked by a journalist and presented with facts. So in terms of fixing this alternative reality, it's democracy reforms that will get better people elected to Congress who are willing to stand up to that propaganda machine that you just described, because otherwise it's like we're in the twilight zone and we're not going to be able to have the bipartisanship that historically has existed in this country.
I'm so glad you brought up H.R. 1, and let's finish on that in our last minute and take us one step deeper, because now that the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, that bill won't necessarily go there to die. It's now Senate 1 as well. Just tell people who aren't familiar, because I know this is so crucial, what you think the biggest reform is in that could expand voting rights on a nationwide basis, when usually it's state by state, just at the moment where I think coming off this fraud about election fraud from the Republicans, there's going to be an attempt to make it harder to vote, restrict mail-in balloting, restrict drop-offs, and other things. So give people the clearest 60 seconds you can on what's in H.R. 1 that's going to expand voting rights for the long term if it gets through both houses of Congress.
Our democracy is under assault. We saw that on January 6th, most recently, and in some of the proposals to make it more difficult for people to vote following what happened in Georgia. The bill H.R. 1, which, as you noted, is also Senate Bill 1, which means that in the Senate, it too will take priority, thankfully, contains three primary things that I think are really worth highlighting. One is automatic voter registration to enfranchise an additional 50 million people nationally. It would end partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts, which is this process by which state legislatures draw lines that look crazy on a map. I mean, they distort and dilute the votes of certain communities, and they pack districts with other folks who share similar views almost nearly uniformly in many instances. And we will replace that process with independent redistricting commissions that will draw those lines to make them more responsive to the American electorate, so that voters can choose their representatives and not representatives choosing their voters. And then finally, it is creating a system of public financing of congressional districts so that the kind of people we get to Congress will not debate whether we need $2,000 survival checks in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. These will be people who are more likely to come from working class environments, who understand that this economy has never worked for everyone, that it's only ever worked for a subset of the American people. And then there's a separate bill called the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And that will primarily be the strengthening of the Voting Rights Act. It's basically a revival of it. You can think of it as a new Voting Rights Act based on more updated data than the one that was passed in 1965. And that was gutted by the Supreme Court in that 2013 Shelby decision.
Congressman Mondaire Jones, freshman Democrat from Westchester and Rockland, congratulations one more time on taking your seat after your historic election. Come back many times during this term. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.